this color guy I'm telling you about. Would you believe it? He makes as much money as me.
Then he must be twice as smart as you.
From the KKFI studios in Midtown, it's time for Khadija and the White Guy. Good morning. I'm Keith Washburn.
And I'm Khadija Hardaway. Toot toot, baby.
There's our toot toot. This morning, we are very privileged to have Reverend Wheeler Parker with us, along with his wife, Dr. Marvell McCain Parker. And Reverend Wheeler Parker was actually an eyewitness to what happened with Emmett Till, and we're going to talk about that today. Khadija, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. So Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black young man who was tortured and killed in 1955 in Mississippi. Oh, I lost my little computer, Lopes. Sorry, you guys. Happens.
So, and, you know, the
here I go.
All right.
In Mississippi, after allegedly whistling at a white woman, then known as Caroline Bryan. A few days later, the 14-year-old African-American Till was kidnapped and murdered. And on January 27, 2017, Caroline Bryan, according to the historian Arthur Noe, claims that Till did not do to her what she claimed in 1955. She was 21 years old and white and said that Till had made sexual advances toward her. That is a caption of what the media has been saying about the current events in the Emmett Till case, which I'm not for sure or not, but I think it has been reopened. Is that true?
Really has never been closed.
Okay.
It's always been open. It's just not active.
Okay. The reason why we're here today is because this is a moment in history. It's a moment in time where the past has met the present. And I think this is very important that we capture it while it's current. And we also have Dr. Parker, Marvell Parker, who is Wheeler Parker's wife. Behind every great man is a great woman, or even greater woman. And she is marvelous, as she says. But she has a book here called Breaking the Silence, The Impact of HIV AIDS on African-American Women and the Silence of the Church. And so she is going to also be with us and give some very insightful information about mobilizing Kansas City. So, callers, I want you to be aware that Reverend Parker will give his story first, and then we will allow you guys to call in and ask the questions. This show is really about you guys and you guys wanting to be educated about the events that took place back in 1955. So without no further ado, we're going to have Reverend Parker tell us the story. But would you please give us just a little background about yourself and what you're currently doing?
My name is Wheeler Parker, and I'm pastor of the Argo Temple Church God in Christ, which started in Emmett Till's grandmother's house in 1926.
Wow.
Born in 1939, I moved from Money, Mississippi to Argo Summit, Illinois, outside of Chicago in 1947, next door to Emmett Till. Of course, in 1955, my grandfather came to Chicago for a funeral, which is Emmett Till's great uncle, and they were going to allow me to go back to Mississippi to visit my uncles. I have three uncles that's younger than I am. And, of course, Emmett wanted to go because we were friends, not only cousins, but we were friends. And they did not want him to go because of his free-loving, prankster-type ways. So he kept insisting, and they finally decided to let him go because what did happen to him, they were afraid could happen, not knowing it was going to happen. So we arrived on a Sunday in Mississippi, and of course on Wednesday, we picked cotton. It's cotton picking time, late August. On Wednesday afternoon, late evening, early evening, we traveled to the store, Mr. Bryant there in Money. And while we were there, I went to the store. There are a lot of stories been told as to what happened at the store, But for 30 years, no one interviewed us or asked us what happened, the one that was actually there. I heard so many stories that never happened. So when we tell our story, they say that we alleged. I went into the store, and while I was in the store, I remember Emmett coming in. I just said, I hope he don't say anything silly, because he was very silly. Never had a dull day in his life. Nothing happened while I was in there. Of course, I left him there about a minute, maybe or less. My Uncle Simeon, who was 12, Emmett was 14, and I was 16, came into the store. Nothing happened while they were there. They came out, and sometime later, Carolyn Bryant came out. And as she went to her left, our right of the store, Emmett gave the wolf whistle. And we could not believe that he did that. We all made a beeline for the car, and we left there in a great hurry. So that's what happened to the story. Some said we told him to go in and say something to her. And it was just a lot of stories that has been told. That's not true. There's Eyes on the Prize account. Mark Curtis and Curtis is telling the story. He was not there at all, but he told the story of what happened. So that's the gist of what happened at the store.
Wow.
So what I've always heard is that he whistled. But as you say, it got embellished by Mrs. Bryant. So let's make that clear. We already said that once. But, you know, she later said that he touched her. Right.
Well, here's
there were
some
several
of what,
things.
Here's some of what she said. She said he caught her hand, grasped her fingers in the palms of his hand with a strong grip. While holding her hand, he said, how about a date, baby? And as she turned around and started back to the back of the store, he came on down the way and caught up with me. These are quotations from her testimony at the trial, September 1955, taken directly from the transcript. This is what she says she doesn't remember, but she does remember that what she said happened did not happen.
But she's now gone back on her testimony and said it didn't happen.
She's
that way.
Saying that it did not happen, but in Tim Tyson's book, there's no detail of what she's saying didn't happen.
Right.
Because she said she doesn't really remember what happened that day.
Well,
but she knows that none of what she said was true. It was a lie.
Well, what needs to be known, too, is that there are several different alleged accounts for what happened. That's not the only scenario. I mean, there's several scenarios. We talked about one last night, which, you know, rumored that he whistled because he stuttered. But
right.
If you could give the account of why he stuttered and that situation,
yeah,
Mr.
Well,
Parker.
First of all, Reverend, did he do that often when he would stutter? Did he kind of do a little whistle?
No.
He's saying no.
It was obvious that he gave a wolf whistle. That's the kind of person he was. He was having fun. He loved to make people laugh. Never had a dull day in his life. So there was no question about the whistle, far as we're concerned.
But what about the stuttering? Did he just
stuttering was very much part of his life. He had a bad stutter. He had polio. It left him with a stutter. So he stuttered. That was his forte in life. He stuttered.
So, you know, there's a whole bunch of accounts. Different media outlets took their own account and turned it their direction. And that's why we have several different accounts.
And you remember, for 30 years, it seemed like you think they would ask the people that were there what happened. They wrote the accounts.
Well, back then, you didn't have a voice.
Yes.
And obviously, with an all-white jury, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That wasn't the time that we were in. Mm-hmm. We're still not in that time, mm-hmm. which is sad. Listen, people, if you're listening to us and you want to join the conversation, you can call in 816-931-5534. I also want to tell the people that are tuning in to Facebook and Instagram, if you cannot hear the callers, you have to turn your radio on to 90.1 FM, and that way you can hear the callers. Also, if you call in, turn your radio down so that you don't echo into our sound system and make it difficult for us to understand you.
Yeah, one thing people don't know is you can get KKFI all over the country. We have callers that have called in from Tulsa, Oklahoma. You can get it. It streams live on kkfi.org. Up in the top right is a little button that says Listen Now. So that's anytime you want to listen to us and you're out of town, you can do it. So actually, Reverend Parker and Dr. Parker could listen to us every week if they wanted to.
Right. And we also have the event coming up tonight. It's at 7 p.m. at the Masquerade Event Hall. That's 3027 Walnut, and that's right across the street from KCPT. And our special guest will be Reverend Wheeler Parker and his marvelous, lovely wife, Dr. Marvell Parker.
Well, I want to ask this question. The guy interviewed Mrs. Bryant in 2008, is what I understand. So it's now 2017, and now it's finally coming out with some of this stuff. So why the gap? Why, if he interviewed her and she said this back in 2008, does anybody know why he kept that information away from the public until just this year?
Well, he's responded to many of the comments that have been placed by individuals, family, and non-family members. What he sent to my husband was a confidential email. However, it's on the internet now, so I don't know how much confidentiality still exists. But he did address that. In fact, it's a 10-page letter that he wrote explaining himself. And prior to that, he did send from Amazon.com, he sent us four copies of all of the books that he's written, which includes The Blood of Emmett Till. And his request was that we read the book so that any discussion about the book could be intelligent and based on the knowledge of the book. However, in the letter, he says that he is a historian. Mm-hmm. And during this time period, he was doing research. And he felt that Carolyn Bryant's admission of the fact that she had lied really would not impact the family because the family always knew that she had lied.
Oh, wow.
So he didn't feel that there was any significance in bringing it out at the time. And he said a historian, he went on and on about the work of a historian and the role of a historian. He said they do not pay their sources and that Carolyn Bryant has not received any money from the book. She did not sell him this interview.
Well, the significance is all wrapped up in what I would like to call reparations, you know. A lot of people believe that if this country was to admit the tragedies of slavery, then repercussions could start. Reparations, I'm sorry, could start. And so I think it's important that it has come out. And I'm glad that the Spirit led it this direction, you know, because part of admitting is one step closer to reconciliation and reparations.
It's hard to believe that he didn't have ulterior motives. But all you can do is surmise. He's saying why he did it, why he waited. But you have your own mind, and you would think that there's an ulterior motive myself.
And when did the book come out? Do you know, Reverend?
I think January 29th or 30th.
Of this year?
Of this year, yes.
Yeah, maybe he thought that if he leaked the information earlier, it would upstage the sales of his book. That would make sense to me, is that he wanted to wait and make big news when the book came out so people would go and buy the book.
Yes,
I would guess.
Well, he says here he did not decide to write the book because of his interview with her, that he his intention was to simply record and place in an appropriate professional archive to be used by future historians.
Wow, so he really thought about the strategy to how he was going to put that out, because the temperature and the climate that we're in, I mean, it's fitting that you would come out with some information like that. You know, it really is.
It certainly has impacted it. If the confession didn't come out, the book would be nothing.
Well, it's at a time where African Americans are not at the forefront of the issues in this country. It's immigration, some other things, you know. And it's something that should always be at the forefront for African Americans. So I am glad that the Spirit led the man to let it out, because we need energy. We need something that gives us hope, and this is a little nugget of hope, in my opinion, that could potentially mobilize, you know, the continuation of the civil rights movement, because we're not done. And by no means are we done with the work that needs to be done. And somehow, I think people have forgotten that. And this spirit has evoked, you know, the recall of your memory, so to speak. If you're tuning in, give us a call, 816-931-5534. If you have questions for Reverend Parker or Dr. Parker, they're here to take your calls.
Yeah, and setting the stage even a little bit further on this story, when you were in money way back then, 1955, I mean, you were with all the kids, right? So it's not like if something happened inside the store, it would have been known to all of you. Isn't that true, Reverend?
If something had happened.
Yeah, let's say that something more had happened, because it's alleged, and of course Carolyn Bryant made this story, you know, so it's alleged that other things happened inside the store. He would have told everybody. He would have been bragging on it, or the other kids would have told on him. Everybody would have known it, wouldn't you think?
For sure. Well, she said that someone came and drug him out.
It was. She said somebody came in the store and drug him out of there?
That's right. Her testimony,
yes. Yeah, that's what she said.
And that did not happen.
Right.
Another nigger came in and grabbed him by the arm and drug him out. That's from the transcript of the trial.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
So she, all right.
But her references to him each time was a nigger.
Okay. And back then, of course, that was a little more PC than it is now, but still unacceptable in our view at this point or any time. And I guess the point that I was trying to make for our audience listening is that this man is not only an eyewitness to him whistling and so forth. Kids talk, and everybody would have known everything that happened, because that's the way it works.
For sure.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Hey, you caught my attention when you mentioned that you guys used to pick cotton. Mm-hmm. And I want to know what context was that in? Was you picking cotton for your family, to raise money for your family? And what was a day like, you know, a typical day in Money, Mississippi, when you were there?
During cotton picking time, school was out. You didn't go to school till the cotton was in. And we were sharecroppers.
Mm-hmm.
That means you shared the proceeds with the landowner.
Okay.
And so didn't own your own land, but you sharecropped. So that was the gist of that. And at the end of the year, you may break even. If he told you, so, next year you're going to get out of debt. Mm-hmm. You had no say in it. You took what was told you. And there was no question. And during the year, you could go to the commissary and pick up things, and they write that on your slip of things you owed against you.
Oh.
So at the end of the year, my uncle trying to tell the landowner, I didn't get this. And he said, well, it's on the books. He said, well, I didn't get that, sir. He said, my wife keeps the records. My daughter keeps the records.
And he trusts him.
She don't make mistakes.
Uh-huh.
And I let him know, you could be killed if you go in the father, just like that.
Well, that's another thing I think we need to make our listeners aware of, if they're not already aware of this. By the way, we have a caller holding, but is that you feared for your life. I mean, when they come to get Emmett Till, I'm guessing that if you don't cooperate, you're afraid they're going to come back, meaning the Klan may come back later and burn your whole house down. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Well, when they came in at 2:30 in the morning, when they came to the door, they had their guns out. You know, they came ready, so they had ups on you. And hearing their voice, knowing the stories of the South, you know what the deal is. People have been killed for reckless eyeball. You have to set the atmosphere of the times. The only way you could understand where it was, you had to live it. But yet still, people stayed there. They learned to live with it. And most did not violate the Southern mores.
So we have a caller. State your name, what part of town you're calling from. You're on the air.
Okay, thanks. This is Rich, always listening to you guys.
Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. First of all, let me comment that whether he whistled or he didn't whistle, he did not deserve what happened to him. Till did not deserve it. No way. Secondly, I'd like to have you discuss the analogy between that and some of the black kids who've been killed by cops recently. idea that they might have had a BB gun or whatever the reasons are that the cops have given. Would you please discuss that analogy? Thank you.
Hey, good comment. Thanks, Rich.
Go ahead.
My name is Wheeler. I always tell black men that you, since you've been in this country, you have been a target and you have been labeled as a sex predator or rapist, and that's been the nature of a black man in America, and it continues over to now. And we have to learn how to tell our boys to survive during this time. We have a lot of work to do, and I don't think we're really preparing them how to survive and to deal with the kind of things they're facing. I don't think they have a good idea of what they're facing. So we have a lot of work to do in that area.
It's sad that we have to think about just the normalizing of an everyday situation. You know, you're walking down the street, you're in your car, you're eating breakfast, you know. It could just turn into a tragic at any moment, and that's sad. We have a caller on the air. State your name and what part of town you're calling from.
This is Maurice Copeland. How
Reckless eyeballing guy. Come on. I knew you was going to call.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Maurice has talked before about this reckless eyeball thing.
I was a child back during that time. I was 7 years old, and my mother taught me how to handle myself because I traveled to the South every year. We were called city slickers, and so was Emmett Till. I'm so glad that his cousin mentioned reckless eyeballing, and I also would like to add attempting outrage. You know, I mentioned that in Kansas City years ago, and people just laughed and laughed and laughed. Copeland, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, I grew up during those times, and like I said, I learned my lesson well. That's why I'm still here, and I still conduct myself in a certain way. So I appreciate the knowledge that you're laying on us here, and I hope people understand how ugly racism and prejudice is, and I'll listen out there.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Maurice.
Well, Maurice, in order to understand and appreciate what I said, you had to live it. When you tell these stories to people, what the South was like, it's hard to believe. Even for me sometimes, did it really happen? And people did not leave because of mistreatment. They learned to live with it. They learned how to survive and stay alive. We left because of economics. Modernization of mechanized farming came in, knocked us out of jobs. We had to go.
Well, Maurice Copeland has talked about this reckless eyeball before, and for the listeners that don't understand what we're talking about, it was on the books, right? I mean, this was a law of the South, may have even been law in Kansas City, and the idea was that if you looked at a white woman the wrong way, that was reckless eyeballs. You could be, thrown in jail for that.
You could be killed. While we were there, it happened to us. Emmett Till and I and my uncles, had a flat in a certain neighborhood, and there was a white lady sitting on the porch. And we were told not to look up there because if anything was said negative, you could be killed. 4 years after Emmett Till, Charles Mack Parker was in jail for a similar situation. They went to the jail and took him out and killed him.
Hey.
There are a lot of things. Emmett was not the first person that was killed. It was like an idea whose time had come. The way of the South, a lot of people were killed, and you never saw them again. Emmett's body was found because it snagged. Otherwise, we would never hear from him again.
So can you tell us, was there a curfew imposed on African Americans in that time?
I don't know about strict curfew, but in Greenwood, Mississippi, a certain time of the night, they say, hey, boy, you're going to be late for Sunday school, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was, I don't know if it was on the books or what.
Was Money, Mississippi referred to as a sundown town?
Money, Mississippi was a hamlet, maybe with two stores. I don't know how to paint the picture. I think maybe 50 people lived in Money because it was fertile land. So people lived throughout on places and stuff. So it wasn't really a town. It's kind of hard to explain, but it was nothing like Greenwood. Mississippi had no large towns. Never had a town other than Jackson over 50,000 people. They probably don't have too many now over 50,000 people because it's in the Delta, it's for farming, and that's the nature of Mississippi.
Oh, wow.
So this little store, the Bryant store, the little grocery store they had there, it was one of the few buildings even in the, quote, town?
Mm-hmm. I passed through there not too long ago, looking to my left to where the railroad runs. I say, hey, I think I just passed through town.
So it's like, you know, if you're going through Oklahoma or something, you see these small towns, and then a mile up you're in another town, and a mile up you're in another town. It's just really a small sector.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a shared by one county, maybe.
It's a spot on the road.
Okay. It sounds
and
like.
And there's nothing there now, not even a post office. I mean, nothing. In the town my wife, people are from, there's nothing but a sign there.
So you said Greenwood, that's right next to it, right? So that's where pretty much people would go into town and do what they needed to do and come back. Mm-hmm. So how did Greenwood feel about it? Are they the ones that the surrounding towns, are they the ones that got on board and really made sure that they were acquitted? How did you come up with a jury when you only got 50 people in town? Ain't it 12 people?
Well, the trial was not held in Money.
Okay.
It went to another county.
See, is that because the body went up the river?
Tallahatchie County. Yeah.
Okay.
Money is in LeFlore County.
Okay.
They found him in Tallahatchie County.
Okay.
So that's how the court, that's how it ended up being held in LeFlore County, some of Mississippi. It's not much better either.
But maybe that's too deep into the law. But if you die in one county, murdered in one county, even though they found your body in another county, in today's modern, wouldn't you be tried in the county that the murder occurred in?
Well, it occurred probably. We don't really know where it occurred.
Mm-hmm.
There's stories about that.
Oh, okay.
He was beaten at the barn. I think in the Look magazine, they said they shot him, I guess, at the river.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably was Tallahatchie County. So it's not clear
what happened
as to where it happened.
Only they have that account.
Where he actually killed, where he actually died at.
Only the perpetrator had.
Right. And they kidnapped him in LeFlore County. Definitely kidnapped him in LeFlore County.
And was the man actually tried and convicted of kidnap?
No. They're supposed to go back. It never happened.
So it never even got to that.
They admit kidnapping. We saw them, you know. They won the case based on what they say it was not the body of Emmett Till. That's why we exhumed his body about 50 years later and did the DNA. We knew it was him anyway.
Right.
But, that's the way that happened.
So for those that have not read the story, they beat him, just unmercifully beat him, then shot him, threw him into the river. The body, as you said, got snagged, so they recovered the body. And, of course, the body was in terrible shape at that point, not only because of the beating, but also because it had been in the water for a couple of days, right?
He was weighed down with a cotton gin, so it was expected that he wouldn't rise back up because of the heaviness of the cotton gin. So,
and the only thing the guy saw was his foot bobbing up and down. The body was weighted down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But his foot was bobbing.
Okay.
And from that, they pulled him out. Normally, you would never be found or heard from again.
So the other part of it that people may not know is that the mother, Emmett Till's mother, insisted that the body come back to Chicago. They didn't want the body to go back to Chicago, but she insisted that it come back to Chicago, and she also insisted on an open casket funeral so that, I guess, thousands of people came to view the body and see, you know, she wanted it to be on display, what happened to her boy.
Mm-hmm. They actually were preparing to bury him in Money. When word was received down there that she did not want him buried there, she wanted him sent back to Chicago, and they were very reluctant to do that. And I think they asked for a promise that the coffin would not be opened. But when she got it to Chicago, she said she didn't make the promise. She wanted it open so she could see. And once she saw it, she said, the world needs to see what they've done to my son.
So, you know, in modern time, Emmett Till has survived in spirit for a long time, which brings me to reference the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crimes Act that allows the Justice Department to investigate and bring to justice those who committed crimes against people during the Civil Rights era. It has been repassed by the President Obama, I think it allows another year for them to investigate. Another 10 years? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I thought the first one was 10 years. And
this one's 10.
Second is 2.
That's awesome, then. That's even better.
They tried to get it unlimited, but it was too much package. It ended up selling for the
Well, 10. You know, when I was working with Alvin Sykes on that first Till bill, people would ask the question, like, why? Why is it important? It was so long ago. Who cares anymore? Well, it goes back to that question of, like, do you believe that African Americans are owed anything for what they suffered? But not only that, but what they built in the United States. And if you do believe that, then you would have to understand why it's important to bring to justice the people that committed these heinous crimes. Because without the burden of guilt in these situations, we can never prove that reparation needs to happen. I am a firm believer in reparations, and people will say you're crazy for that, but I believe after the point of slavery, when African Americans were freed, what they suffered in trying to build themselves up was tremendous, and it was a loss of pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. Not a loss of, you know, you're no longer a slave and I'm not giving you anything. No, people's land was taken from them. Their families were killed over it, you know. And the times was a suffering time. And I believe that there should be some kind of reward for that. So in my opinion, I am very proud of that bill. And I would like to see as much happen with it to bring people to justice. And people say, well, these people are old. Well, the law was put there with no statutes of limitation for murder for a purpose. It was put there for a purpose. And that's because that's the most heinous crime that you commit against another human being is to take their life. And so, you know, I'm a firm believer in bringing people to justice, no matter what age they are. Now, whatever their penalty is at the end of the day, that's left up to the jury.
Well, you know, in school in America, well, when I was in school, I assume they still stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. As an elected official, we stand and say it before every village board meeting. And I think one line says that liberty and justice for all.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
So we are part of the for all, but we haven't been recipients. But we've said it, we've been taught it, and we believe that we deserve it. Liberty and justice for all.
I'm with you 100%. We have a caller?
We don't have a caller yet, but your dad, Mr. Kareem, is putting a caller on the line, so we'll have it pretty soon. But I wanted to ask the question, Khadija, because you're bringing up, you know, reparations and so forth. Just, you know, should Carolyn Bryant be prosecuted now? What our feeling is on that? In other words, you know, should she be on trial for, I don't know, at the very least, perjury, I suppose?
You know, I would like to feel warm and fuzzy for Carolyn Bryant, but the real deal is that the movement calls for her to be tried. The movement calls for it. There's no other way to bring America to justice and people to start admitting the truth. They won't admit it. America's white nation will not admit the crimes that they have committed against African Americans. And this is the only way to bring that burden of truth to the forefront. And so I say it has to be done. Never mind her feelings or how old she is. It's a whole world of people who are suffering from what she has said and done.
Okay. Reverend Parker, any thoughts on that? Then we do have a caller.
Well, quickly, the law is for the lawless. Most crimes are never solved. Does that mean that the people who committed them get away? We believe there's a law that you reap what you sow. Of course, we would like to personally see it done, but no one gets away.
That's a really good point.
How many times have we paid for things that we've done? We just don't tell people why it's happening, but we know exactly why things happen to us. So Carolyn, she's not going to escape. She can't escape.
Well, the statute of limitation has expired on perjury, 1955, and she committed perjury again in 2005 when she testified, when she was investigated and interviewed by the FBI. So there's no recourse, even though she's admitted now that she lied. The statute of limitation is passed. And that could be one reason why there was a delay in revealing this. You know, we can read between the lines.
Yeah, sure could.
The statute of limitation has expired. But this doesn't exonerate her from being a co-conspirator. And if she would tell the truth, then she probably could be charged as a co-conspirator of the murder, because Mose Wright said that when they took Emmett out of the house and took him to the car, which was in the driveway, he perceived that there was a voice of a woman who identified Emmett. And at some point between them kidnapping him and killing him, she had to identify him as being the boy that did the talking in the store.
And grabbing her around the waist.
When they came in the house, and I've gotten all this information from the transcript. My husband and I are writing a book of his memoirs, and all of this information is going to be detailed in his book. The title of his book is A Few Days Full of Trouble. But they came into the house, and they asked specifically for the boy that did the talking up at the store. So they didn't know which of those seven or eight boys in Mose Wright's house was the boy. However, when they accosted Emmett, he got up and got dressed and went with them, him knowing that he was the one that had done the talking. But she had to confirm that he was the right kid. And according to the FBI investigation, which took place in 2005, twice during the few days between the incident at the store and them arriving at Mose Wright's house on that Sunday morning, they had brought two other young black boys to Carolyn Bryant.
Oh, wow.
To determine whether or not they were the boys, either, that had done the talking at the store. And both times she said that they're not
so
the one.
So basically premeditated on the
They were
the
looking for him between Wednesday and Saturday. They just finally, I guess, found out which house he was in and found the right kid. But they were looking for the boy that did the talk at the store. So she's a co-conspirator.
Okay. Yeah, we do have a caller now. Thank you. That is great information. You heard it right here on KKFI, Khadijah and the White Guy, exclusively.
She graduated from the Howard University. She has her law degree.
No, I am. I received a fellowship to Harvard. I graduated from Northeastern Illinois University
in
Chicago. But yeah, I did receive a fellowship to Harvard. And like I said, my husband and I are writing his memoirs and the research and the information that we've gathered for the detail of the trial and the murder is all taken from the transcript of the trial. And we actually saw a school from Fairmont, Virginia, do a reenactment of the trial. And it was awesome.
Oh, it was awesome. I bet you
have. And we've made arrangements and worked on the fact that we'd like for the world to be able to see a reenactment of the trial. And this school is going to travel to Sumner, Mississippi at the end of this month, March 27th, 28th, and 29th. And they're going to do a reenactment of the Emmett Till murder trial in the Sumner Courthouse, which has been restored.
Right.
Wow.
Nice.
All right, we do have a caller. Let's get our caller on the air. We lost one caller, so if you would call back in. And caller, you are on the air. What's your name and what area of town are you calling in from?
Yeah, this is Maurice again.
Hey, Maurice.
Yeah, one more thing. I think one reason that we're not receiving justice is because we're aiming at the wrong person, the wrong people. Look, we were terrorized. All of our lives, just our daily life, was terrorism in the South and many other places.
Who are the wrong people, Maurice?
What do you say?
Who are the wrong people? We're aiming at the wrong people. Who are they?
Okay, give me a chance, Khadijah. The system. The system set up these laws. The system set up these laws to protect the perpetrator back then. They were not going to be guilty. You know, you heard of kangaroo trials. That's all we had. The system, that's why the laws have changed over the years, because they were wrong. So the system judged themselves wrong. That's why the laws have gotten better. That's why you don't have the terrorism in our black communities like they used to. Every day was terrorism. You say was that a sundown town? Every town that we perceive as towns were sundown towns all of our lives. When I was a child, you couldn't go downtown. Indians used to couldn't come to Kansas City. They would have to be out of town legally by Monday morning. They would round them up down at Union Station and put them on a train. Everything was set up against us.
Okay,
that's why
Maurice.
We cannot go to international court. That's why we have been charged with crimes of human crimes. That's why we have to look at these things. If we want justice, we have to take the system on, have our lives since slavery judged in the international court. And the United States will not go there. Obama didn't go there.
Okay, Maurice.
Okay, okay.
Back then in 1955.
Thank you.
No. I got a question for you. Back then in 1955, who was the system? Please explain that to me. Who was the system?
I think he hung up.
Oh.
So he's raising a good point, and he's raising a point that you're working on, which is, you know, it's the system. It's not just, you know, going to court, you might as well just call it a loss, right? I mean, there was no way that they were going to get any justice going to the court back in 1955. Everybody could plainly see that.
Well,
and
as
Reverend Parker pointed out, they didn't even get a kidnapping conviction on the guy.
I think to say the system all the time is an easy way to just say that it's the Matrix or it's this, you know, superpower. But who runs the system? And we got to get to that point of, like, where did the beginning of the system start? Who built it? Why is it running the way it is? And why are they doing it the way they're doing it? At some point, we got to get to that point and stop just saying the system.
Well, in the South, we need to point out, in the South, this is the first time in the history of America that a white man was being put on trial for doing something to a black, to my knowledge. That was progress.
Absolutely.
That was progress to have a trial. As a matter of fact, the guys would not come at first. They were insulted, saying that they were protecting a Southern way of life, and you bringing us in to trials over this. So progress was made that they had a trial. And Mrs. Teal was wondering, was she going to be shot every day in court, not afterwards? You have to know the atmosphere of the time.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather went home one night, couldn't sleep. He slept in a cemetery. He said, white men around your house all night last night. You had no protection in that system because they did what they wanted to do.
Right.
The Justice Department, the FBI president, they didn't bother those people. They had their own way of confederatism, and they did what they wanted to do. Even when they had the FBI did the investigation about Emmett Till, they turned information over to an all-black grand jury. And the black grand jury said, we find nothing to prosecute Carolyn Bryant or anybody else. A no true bill. So all the information is still there, and it can be used a lot of times. And the only people can do that now is the people in the district court, which is black. Mississippi has more elected black officials than any other state in the union.
Oh, wow.
So it's in the hand of black people right now.
There's still a lot of fear.
Of
reprisal, even though this is 2017. Some things have changed.
Some things have not changed.
Yeah. And there's still fear.
So we have a caller on the air. State your name, what part of town you're calling from. You're on the air.
Hi, my name is Jen. I'm from South Kansas City.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, girl.
Hey. I just want to say how excited I am to hear you all talk tonight, and I think it's so important. Just the subject matter that we're going to be hearing from you guys. I'm personally very excited. about the event tonight, so toot toot. But I also just wanted to make a comment about, Khadija, you had said something about, you know, that back in this time when Emmett Till's murder occurred, and just mentioning the idea of reparations. And I just want to say that that can't be just like a black folks opinion. That has to be a white folks agreement, like, and it should be. We, you know, we need to admit the sin of this nation as white folks and say, because then, like you were just discussing, the black people who are in elected positions now, they need to have bipartisan, like, agreement that this happened, that there's confession and that there's forgiveness, because we're never going to move forward as a nation. And the idea that, like, oh, well, they just, you know, need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. The point is they've never had boots. We need to, as white people, admit that and say this is all needing a restructure here and a humility and an extension of just our hearts to one another as humans and not, anyway, you know, everything that's occurred to them is not okay, and it's still happening, unfortunately. Right. So I just wanted to make that comment, and I think events like you're doing tonight is just another step forward into, I think, white folks understanding and having compassion and humility, quite honest.
Thank you, Jen. I can't wait to see you tonight.
All right. See you then, guys. Great show. I'm loving it.
All right. Thanks for calling in. And we do have one more caller. We'll get that person on right now. If you would, tell us your name and area town you're calling in from. You're on the air. You're on the air, caller.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, you are on the air.
Yes, my name is Freddie Malone, and I'm in downtown Kansas City right now.
Okay. Go ahead with your comment or question.
Okay. Hey, you know, I've been listening, and I get the in and out of my vehicle making deliveries. Mm. But my point is, my issue is that a lot of times...
You're breaking up. You're breaking up just a little bit.
That are made between... Can you hear me?
Yeah,
you're breaking
if you
up.
Would, if okay. You're moving around, stay stationary.
The differences that are made between people. Some things in this society and how things have been orchestrated, it is going to be in a certain way. But yet still, we have to realize that we as a people must come together and work as a unit. We can't separate and just be African-Americans or Mexicans or whatever the case may be. Until we come together as a people and realize that the situation that we're dealing with is not going to change. You know, people fail to realize that sometimes if you have a killer, and a killer that's killing maybe their favorite target is a black person, but they fail to realize that if there are no more black people, then the killer is not going to stop killing. He's going to kill others. There is a difference in a disparity and a unfairness that's been done.
Yeah, good comment. We're kind of losing you a little bit there, Freddie. You're just cutting in and out, but that's a great comment, I think. Let's see what our guests have to say about that, is that we got to come together as all people, because I think Martin Luther King had a quote that goes something like, an injustice for one person threatens everyone. So that's more or less what I hear Freddie saying. Thanks for calling in this morning, Freddie.
You wanted to comment to him? Or
I think the previous caller hit it, the nail on the head. It has to become an issue with the powers to be for reparations to come to pass. The thing about African Americans, we got a preconceived idea. When you can't come from slavery to here, the thing is you're doing good, you're making progress. Let's not leave it alone. Let's keep doing it. We're going to get better. They're not thinking in terms of reparation. You should be appreciative and grateful for what you're getting. And that's the idea of the powers to be. Until they change, there's not going to be any reparations. If you go back to history, they had it for a short time. When Lincoln died, that's when we lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
It took everything back. You know the story. So it's the powers to be. At that time, it was the powers to be that instituted it. Since then, we haven't had anyone with that fire in their belly with power to make a change. So the idea of America, we should be appreciative. We're doing good. Don't rock the boat.
So we are going to give Dr. Marvell Parker a few minutes to discuss her book and just a small portion of what she's going to discuss tonight about mobilization.
Yeah, Dr. Parker?
We're going to talk tonight about mobilizing the community, community organization, bringing a community together, create an action plan, strategize, create goals and objectives, and to work as a unit toward addressing the problems that we face in our communities. My husband and I started this type of work in 1992. We created a nonprofit, faith-based organization in our town. I went to work one day and there was graffiti on the building, and my husband said, our building has been slated to be burned. And so what's going on? Somebody needs to do something. And a voice inside me said, you do something. I'm like, well, what can I do? I'm just one person. And the answer that came back to me was, tell people what you see. So I started talking about what I saw, that if we didn't take action and become proactive, our community was going to be gang-ridden, drug-ridden, and my husband and I being self-employed, people were going to be afraid to come to our places of business. He had a barbershop, and I was next door with a travel agency, and 25 years ago, we were still young people, and we needed to work, and we couldn't have our businesses or our clients intimidated by gangs and by violence. So as I began to talk about what we needed to do, there were people that were just waiting in the wings that said, yes, we need to do something. Yes, we want to help. So we started our, created the nonprofit organization. Our government officials saw that we were mobilizing the community, trying to work together. They came and said, what can we do to help you? And 25 years later, that organization is still going. We received a federal grant in 1998 to build a community service center, which in 2001 it was completed, and 2003 we dedicated that center to the name of Emmett Till, so it's called the Emmett Till Community Service Center. We provide programs, after-school programs for youth and programs for seniors. We target at-risk families and youth, parenting classes. We haven't worked wonders, but we were able to put a stop to the escalation of crime and drug activity in our community. In 2005, by then I was working for the municipality as Director of Community Development. We went on line and started looking for resources from the federal government. We found a program called the Weed and Seed Initiative, and we applied for that grant. It was a $1 million grant. We were awarded it in 2009.
Hey.
And the weed component is to weed out crime. That's the law enforcement component. The seed was for prevention and intervention initiatives. The program is now defunct, but the funding for the program is defunct, but the program is still operational in our community. We have a community policing initiative that is still vibrant. The community and the police meet monthly to discuss the problems in the community and in their neighborhood. They work together. We still have crime. We still have drug activity, but it didn't take over our community. We took over our community, and we said, you're going to have to respect us. You're going to have to respect our businesses. You've got to go underground because we're not going to allow you to ruin our community and make our businesses leave town because of fear for their safety.
So, you know, initially when we thought about bringing Mr. Parker into town, you know, it's something the way God can really gift you more than what you expect if you just take the initiative to do something. And I am so pleased and honored and humbled that you've decided to come along. You know, we initially said bring your wife, but I didn't know the purpose behind it. But I'm so glad that God had, you know, another plan. And just wanted the people to know that I believe that we have some strong organizations out here, and I believe that they're doing great work. But we are missing the component of unity and gathering together and doing things that will get us collectively ahead. And that's what this program is all about, is trying to bring us together. It will be held tonight at 7 p.m. at the Masquerade Event Hall. It's called Civil Rights 2.0. The struggle continues. The address is 3027 Walnut Street. That's Kansas City, Missouri, and it's right across the street from KCPT. Again, I am so humbled and grateful to God for having two wonderful people in our presence.
Absolutely, and I second that. What a powerful team we have here. So, yes, Dr. Parker has her doctorate in divinity, and, of course, we have Reverend Wheeler Parker. Both of them will be there tonight, and along with Khadija Hardaway.
Get that toot-toot, baby.
I want to thank our guests for coming on today.
Thank you.
Yes, it was great to have you, and hope you will join us tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll be there at Masquerade Hall, as Khadija said. We're going to end it with Stevie, and coming up next, as always, is Larry J. bringing you that sweet Southern soul.